sink down and steal away at once, without any of the hurry and prompt of dying. Yet it is happier still to glorify God in our death as well as our life. Tuesday the 23rd. I was in the robe chamber adjoining the House of Lords when the king put on his robes. His brow was much furrowed with age and quite clouded with care. And is this all the world can give even to a king? All the grandeur it can afford? A blanket of ermine round his shoulders, so heavy and cumbersome he can scarcely move under it. A huge heap of borrowed hair with a few plates of gold and glittering stones upon his head. Alas, what a bauble is human greatness, and even this will not endure. At Dover Castle, 1756, Monday, January 26. I rode to Canterbury and preached in the evening to such a congregation as I never saw there before, in which were abundance of the soldiers and not a few of their officers. Wednesday the 28th. I preached about noon at Dover to a very serious but small congregation. We afterwards walked up to the castle on the top of a mountain. It is an amazingly fine situation, and from hence we had a clear view of that vast piece of cliff, which a few days ago divided from the rest and fell down upon the beach. Friday the 30th. In returning to London, I read the life of the late Tsar Peter the Great. Undoubtedly he was a great soldier, a general, and a statesman, scarcely inferior to any. But why was he called a Christian? What has Christianity to do either with deep dissimulation or savage cruelty? Friday, February 6th. The fast day was a glorious day, such as London has scarcely seen since the Restoration. Every church in the city was more than full, and a solemn seriousness sat on every face. Surely God heareth the prayer, and there will yet be a lengthening of our tranquility. Preaching to a press gang. Monday the 23rd, I paid another visit to Canterbury, but came in too late to preach. Tuesday the 24th, abundance of soldiers and many officers came to the preaching, and surely the fear and the love of God will prepare them either for death or victory. Wednesday the 25th, I dined with Colonel Blank, who said, "No men fight like those who fear God. I had rather command 500 such than any regiment in His Majesty's Army." Thursday, March 11, I rode to Kill and preached to a large and attentive congregation. A great part of them were seafaring men. In the middle of my discourse, a press gang landed from a man of war and came up to the place, but after they had listened a while, they went quietly by and molested nobody. Monday the 15th, I rode to the Old Passage, but finding we could not pass, we went on to Purton, which we reached about 4 in the afternoon. But we were no nearer still, for the boatmen lived on the other side, and the wind was so high we could not possibly make them hear. However, we determined to wait a while, and in a quarter of an hour they came of their own accord. We reached Coleford before 7 and found a plain, loving people, who received the word of God with all gladness. Friday the 19th, I rode over to Howell Harris at Trafeca, though not knowing how to get any further. But he helped us out of our difficulties, offering to send one with us who would show us the way and bring our horses back. So I then determined to go on to Holyhead after spending a day or two at Brecknock. Saturday the 20th, it being the day appointed for the justices and commissioners to meet, the town was extremely full, and curiosity, if no better motive, brought most of the gentlemen to the preaching. Such another opportunity could not have been of speaking to all the rich and great of the county. They all appeared to be serious and attentive. Perhaps one or two may lay it to heart. Monday the 22nd. It continued fair till we came to Wolfe, where I preached to the usual congregation. Mr. Phillips then guided us to Royder, about 14 English miles. It snowed hard behind us and on both sides, but not at all where we were. Tuesday the 23rd. When we took horse, there was nothing to be seen but a waste of white. The snow covered both hills and vales. As we could see no path, it was not without much difficulty, as well as danger, that we went on. But between 7 and 8, the sun broke out and the snow began to melt, so we thought all our difficulty was over. About 9, the snow fell faster than ever. In an hour, it changed into hail, which, as we rode over the mountains, drove violently in our face. About 12, this turned into hard rain, followed by an impetuous wind. However, we pushed on through all, and before sunset, came to Dalgelie. Waiting for the ferry. Here we found everything we wanted except sleep, of which we were deprived by a company of drunken sea captains who kept possession of the room beneath us till between 2 and 3 in the morning. We did not take course till after 6, and then we could make no great speed, the frost being exceedingly sharp and much ice in the road. Hence we were not able to reach Tannibal till between 11 and 12. An honest Welshman here gave us to know, though he spoke no English, that he was just going over the sands. So we hastened on with him, and by that means came in good time to Carnarvon. Here we passed a quiet and comfortable night and took horse about 6 in the morning. Supposing after we had ridden nearly an hour that a little house on the other side was the ferry house, so we went down to the water and called a main, but we could not procure any answer. In the meantime, it began to rain hard, though the wind was extremely high. Finding none would come over, we went to a little church which stood near for shelter. We had waited about an hour when a woman and girl came into the churchyard, whom I did not mind, supposing they could speak no English. They were following a sheep which ran close to us. I then asked, "Is not this Baldon Ferry?" The girl answered, "Baldon Ferry? No, the ferry is 2 miles further." So we might have called long enough. When we came to Baldon, the wind fell, the sky cleared up, the boat came over without delay, and soon landed us in Anglesey. On our way to Holyhead, one met and informed us that the packet had sailed the night before. I said, "Perhaps it may carry me for all that." So we pushed on and came thither in the afternoon. The packet did sail the night before and got more than half sea over, but the wind turning against them and blowing hard, they were glad to get back this afternoon. I scarcely ever remember so violent a storm as blew all the night long. The wind continued contrary the next day. Irish Honesty. Monday the 29th. We left the harbor about 12, having 6 or 7 officers and abundance of passengers on board. The wind was full west, and there was great probability of a stormy night. So it was judged best to put back, but one gentleman, making a motion to try a little longer, in a short time brought all over to his opinion. So they agreed to go out and look for a wind. The wind continued westerly all the night. Nevertheless, in the morning we were within 2 leagues of Ireland. Between 9 and 10 I landed at Howth and walked on for Dublin. The congregation in the evening was such as I never saw here before. I hope this also is a token for good. Wednesday the 21st. In conversing with many, I was surprised to find that all Ireland is in perfect safety. None here has any more apprehension of an invasion than of being swallowed up in the sea, everyone being absolutely assured that the French dare not attempt any such thing. Thursday, April 1st. I bought 1 or 2 books at Mr. Smith's on the blind quay. I want to change for a guinea, but he could not give it, so I borrowed some silver of my companion. The next evening, a young gentleman came from Mr. Smith's to tell me I had left a guinea on his counter. Such an instance of honesty I have rarely met with, either in Bristol or London. A remarkable premonition fulfilled. Wednesday the 28th. I rode to Tullamore, where one of the society, Edward Willis, gave me a very surprising account of himself. He said, "When I was about 20 years old, I went to Waterford for business. After a few weeks, I resolved to leave it and packed up my things in order to set out the next morning. This was Sunday, but my landlord pressed me much not to go till the next day. In the afternoon, we walked out together and went into the river. After a while, leaving him near the shore, I struck out into the deep. I soon heard a cry, and turning, saw him rising and sinking in the channel of the river. I swam back with all speed, and seeing him sink again, dived down after him. When I was near the bottom, he clasped his arm round my neck and held me so fast that I could not rise. Seeing death before me, all my sins came into my mind, and I faintly called for mercy. In a while, my senses went away, and I thought I was in a place full of light and glory with abundance of people. While I was thus, he who held me died, and I floated up to the top of the water. I then immediately came to myself and swam to the shore, where several stood who had seen us sink, and said they never knew such a deliverance before, for I had been under water full 20 minutes. It made me more serious for 2 or 3 months. Then I returned to all my sins. But in the midst of all, I had a voice following me everywhere. When an able minister of the gospel comes, it will be well with thee. Some years after I entered into the army, our troop lay at Phillipstown when Mr. W. came. I was much affected by his preaching, but not so as to leave my sins. The voice followed me still, and when Mr. J.W. came, before I saw him, I had an unspeakable conviction that he was the man I looked for. Soon after, I found peace with God, and it was well with me indeed. Preaching in a Loft, Monday, May 10th. I went forward to Clonmel, the pleasantest town beyond all comparison which I have yet seen in Ireland. It has 4 broad, straight streets of well-built houses, which cross each other in the center of the town. Close to the walls on the south side runs a broad, clear river. Beyond this rises a green and fruitful mountain and hangs over the town. The vale runs many miles both east and west, and is well cultivated throughout. I preached at 5 in a large loft capable of containing 500 or 600 people, but it was not full, many being afraid of its falling, as another did some years before, by which several of the hearers were much hurt, and one so bruised that she died in a few days. Tuesday the 11th, I was at a loss where to preach, the person who owned the loft refusing to let me preach there, or even in the yard below. And the commanding officer, being asked for the use of the barrack yard, answered, "It was not a proper place." "Not," said he, "that I have any objection, Mr. Wesley. I will hear him if he preaches under the gallows." It remained to preach in the street, and by this means the congregation was more than doubled. Both the officers and soldiers gave great attention, till a poor man, special drunk, came marching down the street, attended by a popish mob, with a club in one hand and a large cleaver in the other, grievously cursing and blaspheming, and swearing he would cut off the preacher's head. It was with difficulty that I restrained the troopers, especially them that were not of the society. When he came nearer, the mayor stepped out of the congregation and strove by good words to make him quiet, but he could not prevail. He went into his house and returned with his white wand. At the same time, he sent for 2 constables, who presently came with their staves. He charged them not to strike the man unless he struck first, but this he did immediately, as soon as they came within his reach, and wounded one of them in the wrist. On this the other knocked him down, which he did 3 times before he would submit. The mayor then walked before the constables on either hand and conducted him to the jail. A terrible dream. Thursday, June 3rd, I received a remarkable letter from a clergyman whom I had been a day or two before. Part of it ran thus. I had the following account from the gentlewoman herself, a person of piety and veracity. She is now the wife of Mrs. J. B. Silversmith in Cork. About 30 years ago, I was addressed by way of marriage by Mr. Richard Mercier, then a volunteer in the army. The young gentleman was quartered at that time in Charleville, where my father lived, who approved of his addresses and directed me to look upon him as my future husband. When the regiment left the town, he promised to return in 2 months and marry me. From Charleville he went to Dublin, thence to his father's, and from thence to England, where his father having bought him a cornetcy of horse, he purchased many ornaments for the wedding. Returning to Ireland, he let us know that he would be at our house in Charleville in a few days. On this, the family was busy to prepare for his reception and the ensuing marriage, when one night, my sister Molly and I being asleep in our bed, I was awakened by the sudden opening of the side curtain and, starting up, saw Mr. Mercier standing by the bedside. He was wrapped up in a loose sheet and had a napkin folded like a nightcap on his head. He looked at me very earnestly and, lifting up the napkin, which much shaded his face, showed me the left side of his head, all bloody and covered with his brains. The room, meantime, was quite light. My terror was excessive, which was still increased by his stooping over the bed and embracing me in his arms. My cries alarmed the whole family, who came crowding into the room. Upon their entrance, he gently withdrew his arms and ascended, as it were, through the ceiling. I continued for some time in strong fits. When I could speak, I told them what I had seen. One of them, a day or two after, going to the postmaster for letters, found him reading the newspapers, in which was an account that Cornet Mercier's going into Christchurch Belfry in Dublin just after the bells had been ringing. He was standing under the bells when one of them, which was turned bottom upwards, suddenly turned again, struck one side of his head, and killed him on the spot. On further inquiry, we found he was struck on the left side of his head. Sunday, July 4th. In the morning, we rode through Tuam, a neat little town, scarcely half so large as Islington, nor is the cathedral half so large as Islington Church. The old church at Kilconnell, 2 miles from Agram, is abundantly larger. If one may judge by the vast ruins that remain, over all which we walked in the afternoon, it was a far more stately pile of building than any that is now standing in Ireland. Adjoining it are the ruins of a large monastery. Many of the cells and apartments are pretty entire. At the west end of the church lie abundance of skulls piled one upon another, with innumerable bones round about, scattered as dung upon the earth. O sin, what hast thou done? The Delights of North Wales. Friday, August 6th. On this and the next day, I finished my business in Ireland so as to be ready to sail at an hour's warning. Sunday the 8th. We were to sail, this wind being fair, but as we were going aboard, it turned full east. I find it of great use to be in suspense. It is an excellent means of breaking our will. May we be ready either to stay longer on this shore or to launch into eternity. On Tuesday evening I preached my farewell sermon. Mr. Walsh did the same in the morning. We then walked to the quay, but it was still a doubt whether we were to sail or no, Sir T.P. having sent word to the captain of the packet that if the wind were fair he would go over, and it was his custom to keep the whole ship to himself. But the wind coming to the east, he would not go. So about noon we went on board. In 2 or 3 hours we reached the mouth of the harbor. It then fell calm. We had 5 cabin passengers beside Mr. Walsh, Houghton, Morgan, and me. They were all civil and tolerably serious. The sailors likewise behaved uncommonly well. Thursday the 12th. About 8 we began singing on the quarter-deck and soon drew all our fellow passengers, as well as the captain, with the greatest part of his men. I afterward gave an exhortation. We then spent some time in prayer. They all kneeled down with us, nor did their seriousness wear off all the day. About 9 we landed at Holyhead after a pleasant passage of 23 hours. Friday the 13th. Having hired horses for Chester, we set out about 7. Before 1 we reached Bangor, the situation of which is delightful beyond expression. Here we saw a large and handsome cathedral, but no trace of the good old monks of Bangor, so many hundreds of whom fell a sacrifice at once to cruelty and revenge. The country from hence to Penmaen Mawr is far pleasanter than any garden. Mountains of every shape and size, vales clothed with grass and corn, woods and smaller tufts of trees were continually varying on the one hand, as was the sea prospect on the other. Penmaen Mawr itself rises almost perpendicular to an enormous height from the sea.